before last Thursday when some new results came out. And so I've actually changed the talk a little bit. But in general, what you'll hear about today is that we're building a path of particle physics or towards doing, you know, precision particle physics actually with IceCube, but most focused on the low energy side of things with deep core and then what we're planning beyond. But to bring it all together, what I did is I drew a simple line, and I call this my neutrino detector spectrum. And the spectrum runs from below 10 MeV all the way up above an AeV in energy. And what I did is I started to draw boxes. Now, if you happened to be thinking about a particular experiment, I didn't actually put experiments here. People seem to get upset when you put an experiment inside of a box. So instead, I draw the box, and then I list, you know, various experiments down here. And the important thing to note is that there were smaller scale, or there have been smaller scale neutrino detectors that have been built to really study carefully the solar and the reactor neutrino experiments. And these are typically at about the 10 MeV level and below. And these include, of course, locally SNOW inside of Canada, but also Super K and then Camland. And then as things go forward, what we've seen most recently are these wonderful results from Daya Bay, which show us that the Theta 1-3 mixing angle in the leptonic sector, that this is actually really quite large compared to what people had expected. And so that's where people are focused on these particular experiments. And then you have the atmospheric neutrino studies, which take you to about 10 GeV or so, maybe a little bit higher. And again, Super K has really paved the way as a large detector for that particular energy region. Now, the accelerator community can't be ignored. They fall into this regime here. And this is basically dictated by the energy of the beams that you can produce, and then you point them at your favorite experiment. And of course, in the news, most recently was OPERA, and then OPERA was out of the news most recently as well. And so we have this community, which is very active. You can see by the number of experiments that are growing in that regime. And then you have this group of people here. And what they do is really quite different. Here, we're actually teasing out the information about the neutrinos' properties. Here, we're actually using the neutrinos' properties as a mechanism to go after physics. And so in these very high energy regimes, in this darker blue, this was where the AMANDA experiment was. This was the precursor for IceCube. IceCube actually is in this entire range here, this light blue bar. And then you have the very, very high energy detectors which go after the GZK neutrinos in the non-accelerator based community. And so this is what our picture is currently in the community. And at that very high energy range, what we've actually started to develop is what we call multi-messenger astronomy. Now, multi-messenger astronomy, what you do is you take your favorite astrophysical source, you have it accelerate your particles to you at the most high energies in the universe, and you focus that and you point it towards the Earth, and then you build your detectors to look for the particles which are being produced. And what we do is we design a program which looks for the protons which are being wrapped up in the magnetic fields in the extragalactic distances from source to Earth. We have the gamma rays which are produced in these mechanisms here, but you also get the neutrino, or at least that's what you expect in these processes. And so you can look for the neutrino, which the community agrees would be the ideal messenger, ultimately produced at source and arriving at Earth with the minimal loss of information and the maximum flux that you could expect. Of course, they are really quite difficult to detect. So what we do is we build a detector like this, which is the IceCube Neutrino Observatory. And what we have here is a cubic kilometer of optical sensors, which look a bit like this. They're called digital optical modules. And what you see in this cartoon is the Eiffel Tower. This is for scale. Atlas would be much smaller. It'd be some little dot right about here. And what you have is in blue, you have the precursor experiment. This was our Pathfinder technology. This was AMANDA 2 detector. It filled this array here. And then you have the entire IceCube array, which is 86 strings. And each of those strings, there's a black dot, which represents each of these optical modules, 60 on each of these strings distributed over this kilometer distance and this square kilometer in a full grid within the detector. And so that's what we achieved in December of 2010. Now, this is the people who do it. This is the IceCube collaboration. It's also quite a bit smaller than the high energy community's experiments. We are now just 38 institutions, about 220 physicists worldwide. And this is where we do it. This is the propaganda photo. If you're bored and you're looking for a nice place to visit, you can always join IceCube and we'll send you here. The South Pole is right about there. That's 90 degrees latitude south. That right there in the background, that's the new Amundsen Scott South Pole base. And a couple of years ago, this is what you would have seen on ice. This was the IceCube drill camp. And this is what we do, is we just melt our way into the glacier. We take 5 megawatts of power to produce basically boiling water, which we focus into a quarter-inch nozzle, and it gives us a hole that looks like this. And what we do is you can see one of our optical modules here. We attach that to this copper cable. We lower 17 meters, which is the specified distance between each optical module and each string. We attach another one. We repeat this 60 times. We repeat the whole process for 86 strings, and then you get yourself a cubic kilometer detector. The modules, it's really quite a simple detector. It's just a large photomultiplier tube. This is 10 inches across. And it's contained in a pressure glass sphere to protect it from the very high pressures when you go into the when you lower it to the deep into the deep glacier. Those columns stay liquid, and so you're basically at the bottom, you're experiencing almost 8,000 psi from just the water column depth, which is on top of this detector. And you have a full onboard data acquisition system, power for the PMT, and then signal processing, which actually goes back up and up to the surface for the data analysis. Now, when you achieve this, what you have is a neutrino telescope in its purest essence. And you are sensitive with this type of detector to all three active neutrino flavors. And so what you can see here is that we can separate the flavor type of the interactions that occur in the detector simply by topology of the event of the light which is detected. So it's just a simple Cherenkov medium detector. And if you have a muon, then you expect a track for your light basically to be produced for the track that the muon follows in the ice. And what you see here, each of these little colored dots, this is a photomultiplier tube which saw Cherenkov radiation in the detector. The color represents timing. Red is early, blue is late in time. So this is clearly a muon which entered the detector here and exited here, and you get this very nice track of the Cherenkov light in the detector. For the cascade events, and so these include neutral current events of all flavors, and then of course the electron neutrino events, the mechanism is that the electron which is produced, it deposits most of its energy locally. You get this sphere of radiation, of Cherenkov radiation, which emanates outwards in an isotropic manner, and you look for these little puffy events in the detector. And so this is one of our latest candidate cascade events, actually, in the deep core detector that I'll tell you about later. And then you can look for the tau neutrino events. We call these composites, and what you have, this is actually an LED calibration simulation that represents what you would expect to see in an event like this. But what you would have is essentially the tau neutrino, it enters, it interacts at this point here. It produces the tau neutrino. The detector is huge, so that despite the energies and the fact that the tau decays quickly, you get this separation between where the tau is produced and where it ultimately decays, which is here. And in the end, we call these double bang events that we actually look for in the detector as a characteristic signature for this type of event. So when you put it all together, you get yourself an observatory, and in this case, it's the IceCube Observatory. And what you can do with this is it's actually a huge science program. You can look for your astrophysical events, so neutrinos from gamma ray bursts, which you would look for in correlation with the gamma rays which are detected with Fermi or with SWIFT. You can look for point sources, active galactic nuclei, the proton accelerators that are producing the highest energy cosmic rays. You can look for a diffuse set of neutrino sources. These usually are associated with the galactic plane for the Milky Way. But then, of course, there's an entire program where you can actually focus on dark matter searches, neutrinos from supernovae, exotic searches, which include looking for magnetic monopoles. And when you get right down to it, what we've ultimately achieved is the world's largest detector bed in a very, very deep glacial site. And so the glaciology community actually like to look at our data and try and learn what they can about how the ice at the South Pole has been evolving over a very long period of time. So the name of the game is that one person's signal is another person's background. And so what I show here is a flux versus the cosine of the zenith. And so that in detector coordinates, minus one in cosine zenith, these are the upgoing neutrinos. It's the neutrinos that are coming from the northern hemisphere up into the Ice Cube Observatory, into the Ice Cube detector. Downgoing are for cosine zenith of one, so those are directly above us. And what you see is that the first events that you're going to get are going to be from atmospheric muons. They're going to completely dominate your downward going signal region. Your first expected neutrino signal that you would look for are from atmospheric neutrinos. These are going to be your largest. And again, depending on what you're looking for, these are either going to be your signal or your background. And you can see that here. The point is that between these two, there's a factor of a million in difference. So the first thing that we do, or the first thing that we did, is we actually looked at these atmospheric muons in our detector. And this is what we found. This was with the 22-string Ice Cube detectors. So this was about a quarter of the current size for this detector a number of years ago. And what we had were almost 4.5 billion well-reconstructed muon events entering this detector from above, with an average energy of about 20 TeV. And what you see when you plot this on a sky map is the following. And there's a clear anisotropy that we discovered in the southern hemisphere for these cosmic gray muons which were being produced. You can clearly see the hot and the cold region in the detector at 20 TeV. Now, this wasn't a complete surprise. About a year or two ahead of that, the Tibet 3 experiment had put out the following. And so you can see from the northern hemisphere a very nice match of the hot and the cold regions in this detector from north to southern hemisphere. This actually is not understood. It's consistent, of course, between these between these detectors at these energy levels, but it is not consistent with the popular models to explain this. And these include, of course, the Compton-Getting effect, which is just the relative motion about the galactic center. And you can see that here. This is a distribution of our anisotropy. And this red line here is what you would expect from the Compton-Getting effect. And they're completely out of phase. And then what we did is we added more data. And so what you see here is the very, very latest on this anisotropy measurement. And it's still a mystery. What we've done is we've added another 2 years of data. This is 59 and 79 strings of the Ice Cube detector. So basically just over two-thirds and then nearly complete. So with those 2 years of data, there's another 10 to the 8 events, which are actually now at about 400 TeV in energy. And so these are actually higher in energy. And you can see that this actually persists at the higher energy. Now, the actual orientation has flipped. And that's not actually understood either, why it is that at 20 TeV, you actually get a rotation between the hot and the cold regions in the detector. But what you have is that this completely persists. If you actually look at the highest energy events that we have for these muons, and these are now well over or near and above a PeV in energy, you can see that this hot and this cold anisotropy completely persists with energy as we add data. And so this is something that we're studying very carefully, because not only is this an effect that we'd like to understand, but it is also a systematic that you would expect in your detector based on your background contributions when you're looking for the neutrino events.
Sure.
Let me think. So this would be 0 hours, and that would be 360. So I'd have to map that to a sky map for you. But where the galactic center is, that's a good question. I'd have to look. Yeah.
So air train cup detectors, as well as sensitive to gamma rays in this energy, are also, I believe, sensitive to charged cosmic rays. Have they seen this effect yet?
At 400 TeV, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen a result from them. Yeah, so the orientation here for Ice Cube at 20 TeV, this is the same as here. And so, oh no, it is consistent. Sorry, it's consistent. No, I'm sorry. No, it's this map here which is consistent. So the blue region is here, This is 0 hours, this is 24 hours. So the blue region is here, and when you come here, the blue region has moved over there.
So there, so for any one energy, it's not changing in time or anything, it's fixed.
It seems to be fixed. It doesn't seem to change in time, but it does seem to be energy dependent with its location. Okay, so we come back to this. So this is what where I introduced signals and backgrounds. So let's say you wanted to start to go after neutrinos, which is what this was really built to do. So what we do is we close a window. We only look at the events that are coming up in the detector because the expectation is that those events have to be a clean neutrino signal. And so this is exactly what we look for. So this is a candidate neutrino event. You can see that this is early, red, blue is late. These are the PNTs that are lit up in this track. It's clearly an upward-going muon-induced event from a neutrino interaction right about here, just outside of the detector. And so these are our signature events. And what we do is we start to put this together. We take all of the events that we're able to reconstruct well, and both in direction and energy, and we plot it on a sky map. And you can see here the galactic plane mapped on this particular sky map. And what you have here, although it looks like it's a bit washed out, there's a little dot for every one of the nearly 40,000 events that we measured and reconstructed with the IceCube 40 string detector in that particular year of data. And then what we do is we start to group those neutrinos according to their direction and according to energy. And what you get is a sky map which looks like this. And so this is the key to our point source search for extrasolar neutrinos, which are entering our detector. And you can see, you can't see, there is a hot spot right about here in this particular detector. There's really no significance for that hot spot in that particular data set. The way that we do this blindly is that we actually compare this sky map, where the hotspot is there, sorry, that sky map, to a series of 1,000 scrambled sky maps where we just take our data and we scramble the orientation for the direction of the neutrino arriving. And what you find is that that particular hotspot, or the hottest spot in the map, is actually reproduced 96% of the time in those scrambled sky maps. So then we can reject this as any realistic astrophysical source, which is good because if you look, if you talk to the astronomers, there's actually nothing there. So we don't stop there, of course. The detector was always taking data, even during its construction era. And so this is the very latest from our point source searches. This is the 40 string and the 59 string, 2 years of IceCube data combined together. And what you can see is that things are changing in this map when you compare it to this one. There's clearly a number of sources which are starting to grow in size along this particular plane that you have here. You also have a new hotspot, which is frighteningly close to Gamingo, which is just over here. And so there's some hints that there may be some correlations starting to peek out. The significance for this is not yet such that you would make any announcement for discovery, but there are some hints that things are starting to build up in these particular maps. Okay. Now, that should be the ecliptic, yeah. So then I take you to the gamma ray burst searches that we do. And this was in news last week, actually. And so that's why it gets a place in this particular talk. What we do for the gamma ray burst neutrinos is we look for events which are correlated in time and direction with observed gamma ray bursts from the satellite experiments. What that allows you to do is it allows you to really narrow your window that you search in, and that allows you to just knock down the background that you would expect. And so you can become very, very sensitive for the astrophysical neutrinos from that search. And so what I show you here is just from the 59-string data set, and what we have are, in that particular data set, 109 gamma ray bursts, which were triggered and were below our horizon. So these are neutrinos, or these were expectations for neutrinos that you would have expected coming up into the detector from a gamma ray burst that occurred in the northern hemisphere. And what we do is we model what you expect for the burst spectrum, for the flux, versus the energy. And this is 10 to the 3 GeV. This is 10 to the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 GeV in energy. Okay, and so this is your expectation for a TeV and up in neutrino energy from these gamma ray bursts. And so each of these lines represents a individual spectrum that you would expect for neutrinos from each of these independent gamma ray bursts. And then what we do is we sum these together, which you see in these deep lines here. And then for the individual gamma ray burst model, and this was the leading model, which was proposed by Waxman and Bacall back in the late 90s, that's shown in this dashed line here. Now, what we found in that data set is that there was no correlation observed. And so for the 59-string data set, what we show here in the dashed green is, the is again, the Waxman-Bacall model that you would expect for a given energy-weighted flux versus energy, which is shown here in our stacked analysis. And then the leading model by Goodyear and all. And what you see in that particular data set was what we achieved in the IceCube 59 string year was this green line here, where we had started to rule out or at least test these models in a stringent way. Now, this has been updated. And so this came out in Nature just late last week. And so this is the very latest on this particular study. And what you have is the IceCube 59 and IceCube 40, 2 years of gamma ray burst searches with this detector. And this black line represents our current limit. This, again, these dashed lines are the were the leading models. And they have, you can see that for energies, basically from 10 to the 5 and, sorry, from about 10 to the 7 and below, these have been stringently tested.
This, how far are these sources?
How far away? Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. They're thousands, or sorry, they could be millions of parsecs. I mean, they're huge distances. They're certainly extragalactic. They may be extra supergalactic.
What's the time window at which you're?
I'll show you that in 2 slides. Okay, so this relates to this. So this is just a nice way of how we can present these results. These are the models. These were the leading models with their uncertainties. Okay, what you see in the black hashed line, this is the ice cube. This is the combined ice cube result, this hatched region at 90% confidence level. This line here, this is the 95% confidence level. So we rule out fully the Waxman model at the 95% confidence. Okay. So to answer your question, so what we do is we do 2 things. So in the model dependent search like this, we use a 14-hour window that we search around, okay, looking for a correlation. For the model independent window, we actually run a full day on both sides of the GRB, of the observed GRB. And so this plot, what you see here is the muon neutrino events, and this is delta time in seconds. And so what you can follow is the number of neutrino events that arrive coincident with this gamma ray burst, and then you look for a direct correlation between the two. Now, this is actually an event, so this line represents your 90% sensitivity, your upper limit. And so that's actually an event which arrived in the detector, but at that time window, that's completely expected. So there's an expectation that if you have a delta T of 100 seconds, that you would get one neutrino event, which is consistent with this in a model-independent search. Okay, so that essentially rules out the same models it tests this in a model-independent way. Let me express that. This blue line, this represents one of the leading models, which was the Goodyear et al. Prediction, and so you can see that we're well below that. Okay.
Sorry, sure. The x-axis is time.
This is time. This is delta time in seconds. So that's searching on both sides of the gamma ray burst arrival of the gammas. Let me put it that way.
Did you find any correlation between the luminous part and or X-ray part and neutrino? Because we have data from luminous and X-ray.
Yeah.
We've
talked to the X-ray community. We actually have a direct follow-up with one of their with one of their observatories. There was no correlation. So actually, I was going to pause here because this is a different part of where the talk is going to go in the next slide. William, yeah.
So how do you establish your pointing resolution if you haven't seen any point sources yet?
So the pointing resolution is actually, so what we do is we look for, so we have, I don't have the slide in this talk. So there's a shadow analysis that we do with the sun and the moon. So the cosmic rays are being absorbed by the sun and the moon. And so what we do is we look back in that direction and we look for a deficit. And so the sun and the moon on the sky is about a half a degree. And what we find is that we can measure the shadow with our detector back in that direction to the same half degree accuracy. And so the accuracy that we quote at about a TeV and up is typically on the order of somewhere between a half a degree and 1 degree resolution for the detector.
And I guess that was my next question. What, over what energy range?
Yeah, it's essentially from a TeV and up.
And that's these models predict something in the 100,000 TeV range.
Your resolution improves as you go up in energy because you get a larger lever arm with the muon. Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand your plot. Is it zero is to the left, or 10 is to the left, and then longer is to the right? Why is it climb?
So you're basically, what you're doing is you're opening a window on both sides of the arrival of the gamma ray burst light. And so as you increase, so what you're doing is you're just increasing the size of that window as you move from left to right. And so the number of neutrinos that you expect in your detector, it grows with that time.
So it's cumulative?
Yeah, it's cumulative, yeah. Okay, so if there aren't more questions on this, I'll just continue with the last half of my talk. We can always come back. Sure. Do you want to ask now? Okay. So this is where I left you. This is where our community is today. And what you'll notice is that I cleverly left in my own biased way this white space here between basically 10 and 100 GeV. And I call that our gap because there really hasn't been an experiment which bridges the energy regime for the very large detectors and the smaller scale detectors. I'm going to call super K small in this energy window. And if you look there, there's all sorts of particle physics to look for. And so there's dark matter, it lives in here. It's actually favored in this regime. There's the muon neutrino disappearance from the atmospherics. There's neutrino mass hierarchy down at this lower edge, and we'll talk about that later today. And then new tau appearance lives here. As you can see, there's the OPERA experiment, which creeps into the 30 GeV regime for where they search for tau appearance. And so I always like this. If I assume this is ice cube, what I realize is that there's a huge distance between these strings, and there's room inside to basically start to put things interior to the ice cube strings. And what we did is we called this deep core. Now deep core, what it's designed to do, and you can see it here in green, this is the location of the deep core detector. What we do is we just concentrate our optical modules much more densely in the deepest, clearest ice, which is completely surrounded by ice cube. And so ice cube interstring distances, the string between those two blue strings, that was 125 meters. In this green region, we halved that. On average, it's 72 meters, and there's actually strings in there, which there's six strings in this location that were added to the ice cube's original design, which only has a 42-meter spacing. Now, this is important because that 42-meter spacing, if you look here, that's actually below the geometric scattering limit for the deepest ice in this plot. And so this means that in that 50-meter window, you can actually get direct photons from the point where they're produced on the muon track to the point where they're actually detected by the optical module. That actually gives you your strongest piece of information for doing reconstructions. The dom-to-dom spacing, the spacing between the optical modules on the strings, this has also been greatly reduced. It used to be 17 meters on these ice cube strings. It's now 7 meters in this deep core region. And so basically, you're just concentrating your photocathode material into this much smaller density of the ice. We also increased the quantum efficiency for the photomultiplier tubes. And in the end, what we achieved is a 30 megaton detector, which has a 10 GeV energy threshold. Now, I compare that, for instance, to Super-K, which is a 50 kiloton detector with where the upper energy threshold was about 10 GeV. Okay. So it starts to really close that gap. And ultimately, what we expect is to achieve on the order of 100,000 physics quality atmospheric neutrinos every year triggering this particular detector. And that's shown here. What I show is the effective neutrino area versus log 10 of the energy. So this is 10 GeV, this is a TeV. And what you can see is that without deep core, you get the black triangles. That's just the ice cube detector without including the deep core detector into its scheme. In red, what you see here, this is what you achieve when you include deep core. And so at 10 GeV up to about 100 GeV, where things start to close off, you have this more than order of magnitude improvement in your sensitivity for these neutrinos. And mapped a different way, this is the effective volume, fiducial volume for this detector, again versus log 10 of the energy. And you can see that even at 10 GeV, you have a 10 megaton detector that you're sensitive to. And by the time you reach 100 GeV, you're up to almost 30 megatons. What makes this special is that someone conveniently came along and they put the world's largest muon veto around deep core, and that's called Ice Cube. And so what we have is that not only do you have the overburden, keep in mind that this is 2.5 kilometers of ice above you to basically reduce that muon flux, but a muon event would have to sneak through essentially 400 meters of active optical modules in the ice and deposit no light with those modules and only put light here in deep core as its first starting point in order to be mistaken for a neutrino event. And so the beautiful thing here is not only can you get a very clean neutrino signal, you can actually achieve better than the 10 to the 6 reduction that you need in order to separate the muon atmospheric muons from the atmospheric neutrinos, but you can also start to look up. And so it allows your detector now to become a 4-pi detector where you can actually look directly into the southern sky. And that's important, the galactic center, and there's a huge number of astrophysical sources that are of interest there. And so this is what we actually are working on. So one of the first measurements that you would like to do is you would like to start to look for the atmospheric neutrinos. And so we've done this. Just to refresh people, the oscillation probability versus the neutrino energy in the deep core's sensitive region looks like this. And so what you can see is that your survival probability for muon going to muon neutrinos at about 25 GeV, it basically disappears completely. And those neutrinos are actually turning into tau neutrinos. And so what you can look for here directly at about 25 GeV in this detector, and what we do look for is not only the atmospheric muon neutrino disappearance, but also the tau neutrino appearance that you would expect in your cascade-type events. And so what you see here is one of our candidate events of a cascade event in the deep core detector. And this was just from 2010, just after we turned this detector on and started full running. And what we find is that there's a lot of these. So in our first data set, what we did is we did some very tight cuts, and the energy is actually a bit higher than what we designed deep core to do. But again, it's the very first analysis where we just tightened all of the cuts to get the purest neutrino signal. And what you have is an abundance of cascade events. This is the first time that a neutrino telescope has actually seen cascade events. So this was actually a fairly significant step in demonstrating the utility of this particular detector. We're still assessing the backgrounds, but in the end, what we had was over 1,000 events in that first data set of good quality cascade events. And when you put them together between the observed and then the two leading models of Bartel and Honda for the atmospheric neutrino production, you can see that in time you can expect to actually be able to start to separate these models with the actual data that we're observing. And this will so our full expectation is that we'll start to stringently test these neutrino models in the near future. Now, the next step, of course, is that, sure. These are, so the cascade events include, so they would include the atmospheric neutrino, electron neutrino events. They would include the tau neutrino events that appear from the oscillation, but they would also include the neutral current of all flavors. So then what you can do is what I show here, where you actually look to measure with some precision the muon neutrino disappearance for these atmospheric measurements. And so we assume the full long baseline in the Earth, so our cosine of the zenith is minus 0.6 and down. So it's essentially the full path length in the Earth, so you get the maximal mixing. And what I show here is our expectation for the null oscillation hypothesis, and then 1 year of deep core data for the normal oscillation hypothesis, which assumes the current best known neutrino mixing angles. And you can see that this is a very clear separation. It's 20 sigma in this particular plot, which is from simulation. The analysis has been underway for the last 6 months, and we're just reviewing the unblinding now in the collaboration. And you should fully expect to see the first measurement of this at this 25 GeV window. Note that this is N channel. It's the number of hit optical modules in the detector. It's essentially a direct energy estimator for what's happening here. This is about 25 GeV right here where you see the maximum. And so we're aiming for the Neutrino 2012 conference in Kyoto to give you these first results from deep core. So favorite topic of mine is indirect searches for dark matter. And so this is the other main point, particle physics point for this particular program. And what you have is your favorite dark matter particle, which is going to come along and collide with your astrophysical body. And over time, it's simply going to collect in the center here. Given that you achieve enough of this over a long enough period of time, these particles are assumed to be Majorana. They'll start to self-annihilate. And in the end, what you have are these high-energy neutrinos. The masses for these are somewhere between GeV and TeV scales. And I'm going to conveniently locate my detector at the South Pole to look for these coming from my astrophysical body. And again, I'm going to fight down the backgrounds that are coming from atmospheric neutrinos now, as well as the atmospheric muons. And so we've done this. And so this is one of our primary searches. This is called the Solar WIMP search, where we actually look back at the sun. And what we have is almost 8 years of data from when Amanda 2 was running by itself to a period of time when both Amanda 2 and IceCube were running together, when IceCube was both about a quarter and half of its current size. When you put that together, you get almost 1,000 days of data for when the sun is below the horizon. Conveniently, that happens 6 months out of the year at the South Pole. And so you have a nice open window that you can search for. And what I show here is in the dots, what you see, that's the data that we achieve. This is the angle with respect to the sun. Zero looks directly back at the sun. This is 15 degrees away from the sun. And the line here is the expected background. Now, you can't see it, but there's actually a gray region which represents the one sigma. Oh, you can see it here. This represents the one sigma expectation on that background. So I'm not going to fool anybody. There's nothing here. If there was a signal, what you would have is this dot would be up here. Okay.
So the background is smallest when looking directly into the sun because you're now shooting across the horizon.
Right, exactly. Yep. Yep, that's exactly right. And so there's nothing here, but if I stopped there, you'd all put me out of business. And so what we have instead is we map this to the same phase space that all of the dark matter experiments exist in. And so this is now the spin-dependent cross-section, WIMP cross-section versus WIMP mass. This is 10 GeV. This is a TeV in energy, or sorry, in mass. And what you see are the leading experiments for the spin-dependent space, which are experiments like Ku and Picasso. And they're shown here. What we have here, this is IceCube's current result. And in blue, this is where our theories live. So this is the minimal supersymmetric phase space where the models still have not yet been tested or had not yet been tested for the spin-dependent interaction. And so you can see very nicely that ice cubes started to lop off the top of this model space. Now, what's probably more interesting is what you'll see this summer. This red line has just appeared on this curve, and what you fully expect, this is what we expect with just 180 days of the full ice cube plus deep core detector. And so we fully expect to test this entire region of the spin-dependent cross-section space and including these MSSM models. And so you'll see these results coming this summer. There's a conference in June, July that we're again targeting for this particular release. So this is where I've now left you. So we've added deep core. It closed this region. But the community is really quite ambitious. They're actually preparing programs for very large-scale detectors, order of 300 kilotons. And their physics focus is, of course, going to be long baseline neutrinos. And as they look larger, they're looking towards doing proton decay at the next level and then supernova neutrinos. And you can see the LBNE experiment, for instance, crept onto this plot. But at the end of the day, when you try and put these under a rock overburden, you're constantly challenged by the engineering feats that you have to achieve to basically construct caverns of that size. And so again, I'm going to point you here. If this was ice cube and deep core, there's still room inside. And what we do and what we're planning is new detectors which take advantage of the fact that you can start to fill in this particular region of the deep core detector. And so I introduced Pingu and Maika. Pingu is actually a character from Switzerland. He's a children's program. And these are the precision ice cube next generation upgrade and then the multi-megaton ice Cherenkov array. And so the goal here is to start to build in this region here where you overlap with deep core and then start to push towards a GeV and then down to about 10 MeV in energy. And it's a very active program. In the last year, the collaboration has grown to more than 70 active members who are actually studying this under ice types of detectors. Now, the goal is really quite simple. For Pingu, I'd like to really add just 20 strings to deep core. There's lots of room to do this. And you would want to push down to about a GeV in energy. For Maika, which is considered the second stage, the goal is to push this much below, so down to about 10 MeV in energy. And the topics of interest change, of course, with the energy scale that you're searching in. And I'll talk to you about those quickly for the end of the talk here. So this is a possible geometry of what Pingu would look like. Pingu wasn't always the most popular, and people started to introduce Feathers McGraw into their talks. He comes from Wallace and Gromit, so there's some competition for this, of course. But that's not unusual. The important thing here, though, is that you can easily distribute your 20 strings throughout the 30 megaton fiducial volume for deep core. So this is a top view. The blue represents where you would put the new strings. The red are where the current deep core strings are in the ice now. And what you really want to do is try and aim for a GeV energy threshold with a 10 megaton detector volume. So this is what we're doing. We're designing this. These are the first curves that you expect to see. So these are the fiducial volumes now versus the log 10 of the energy scale. This now goes down to a GeV in energy. And you can see that by adding these 20 strings, you get a huge increase in your sensitivity or in your neutrino detector size. For the triggered events.
So on the previous slide, why are the deep core strings asymmetric?
Asymmetric. So they're fairly symmetric here in this.
But you have two in the middle there.
These two in the middle. So this was an interesting bit of politics in the IceCube collaboration. I really wanted to put two here. And other people in Ice Cube really wanted, so Ice Cube goes all the way out to about there. And so other people wanted to add two strings out here, way, way out, to start to try and extend the detector response for very high energy neutrinos. This is where they ended up. So we made a convincing argument that by adding the strings here, you actually, and it's true, you actually really start to get a lot more information to this. These strings here, this group of six, you really enhance your reconstructions in that particular local region of the detector. Things are asymmetric here because someone left a giant garbage field, which has been buried under into the glacier at this point from the old station. Okay. So this is what we're aiming to achieve. The physics program is much like you saw with deep core, only at the next level. And so you, of course, you can really start to probe the lower mass WIMP regions. And there's some tantalizing hints that WIMPs may be low in mass. And so this is of great interest to do. You also start to be able to map the not only this valley, but also this peak and this valley here simultaneously with the same detector. This is the first time a detector would be able to sample multiple oscillation points in this particular energy. And interestingly enough, in that region right there, you get a splitting for the normal and the inverted hierarchies. And so you could actually imagine chasing that particular type of measurement with this detector. At the same time, you're going to calibrate the ice like crazy, because what you want to really do is push the research and development towards your next step in the ice. Now, just a short aside for the mass hierarchy. So as I said, what you have is this splitting which occurs between the normal and the inverted hierarchies and for the full long baseline. And so what I show here is that you get a large splitting here, but you also get a split and a shift here in your energy at where these peaks occur for the normal and the inverted hierarchies. So with a detector where you can actually measure the full baseline from the atmospheric neutrinos, you get a pure signal where you could actually start to separate these things, assuming, of course, that Theta-1-3 was large, and it turns out that it is. For these particular studies, Theta-1-3 was very close to 0.01, that's exactly, or sorry, 0.1, which is very nearly what we are measured according to Daya Bay. And so this looks really quite promising now for the future. And so we actually did this study, a student and I did this last summer at Alberta. And of course, it's very preliminary. But in red and blue, you see the normal and the inverted hierarchies. This is the angular window, which is basically for the full long baseline going back to the detector. There are statistical error bars on these points. These are the number of events with 5 years of the Pingu detector in this particular energy and angular window. You can see this beautiful separation statistically that you can achieve between the normal and the inverted hierarchies. Now, there's a huge caveat there. You're only going to be able to make this measurement, of course, if you can control the systematics, and that comes back to the calibration program that we would ultimately target. Now, for MICA, which is...
There's also potential systematic in the atmospheric modeling.
Absolutely, yeah, there's a 10-15%. But the hope is that what you can do is a ratio test where you can actually divide that out. So then what we're thinking about is the next step. So this is MICA. And instead of 20 strings, I'm actually dreaming of a few hundred strings. The detectors actually change. They become what I call line detectors instead of these individual optical modules. And you can see an example of this is now the deep core region filled in with 250 strings that you would want to achieve. The goals change entirely. What you would like to really do is do Cherenkov ring imaging directly in the ice. And that allows you to do particle identification. I now use both IceCube, deep core, and Pingu as active vetoes. And sorry, IceCube and deep core as active vetoes because this completely is surrounded by the deep core strings. And the point is that I can do all of this without doing any excavation. My detector medium is what's going to hold my detector together. These are an example of a Cherenkov. This is a cartoon of a Cherenkov ring going off. These are my line detectors. You can see that there's multiple PMTs, which are facing in all directions. And they're distributed throughout the volume. And then you can pick up the slices of the Cherenkov ring going through individual parts of these detectors and ultimately reconstruct that. So what we'd really like to target is proton decay. Just to put it into context, I'm aiming for 5 megatons at 10 MeV. What that means is that I have on the order of 5×10^35 protons, free protons, inside of that fiducial volume. The current best theories tell us that the grand unified limits for proton decay are at the 10^36 level. Okay, so this is the size that you really need to aim for if you want to make this type of measurement. And so what we are studying is the proton decaying into the pi zero e plus. This is what you can do very nicely with a water sharing cough detector. And so it of course is going to rely on ring imaging and controlling the backgrounds, the background estimates for this particular detector. Now this is the hard part. At the same time, if I actually construct a detector like this, what I get is a detector which is sensitive to supernova neutrinos at sort of the 10 MeV energy threshold. And one of the important things to consider is that if I create a 5 megaton detector which is sensitive to 10 MeV neutrinos, I have created a detector which is sensitive to 10 megaparsecs. So it includes the entire local supercluster of galaxies. So this is proton decay in the ice. And so this is in simulation, of course. We haven't observed this. This was one of our very first just really simple detector designs that we were thinking about last summer. And I don't know if you can see it. Oh, you can see it better here. You can see very clearly the three rings. You get the positron, which is the large ring in the bottom corner, and then there's two fuzzy rings that you get in this detector that you can actually extract from the gamma that you get from the pi zero decay. And so that's actually quite a nice that's quite a nice event. This isn't just at random that I scanned thousands of events to find this. This is event number one in that data set. And so what I had is a very talented undergraduate, and she actually started to put together the algorithms to look for the reconstruction of these events. And you can see in one of the standard algorithms that she created, you can see the positron peaks out very nicely, and then the two gamma, these points, these center points represent the center point of the rings that you saw in the last image. And so the algorithms work even with a fairly diffuse photocathode. And so this is actually quite promising going forward. These are the supernovae. So the point is that if you create a detector which is about 5 megatons, 6 megatons in size, you're going to be getting neutrinos from a supernovae once or twice a year. Okay, that's the size that you're sensitive to. And you contrast this with the expectation that we currently have for our detectors, which is about once every century. So this would be an impressive step forward for not only the entire community, but actually understanding the supernova physics. These are what our modules look like. This is a cartoon of one, just to demonstrate that this isn't completely crazy. These are the modules for the KM3NET detector, which is being created in the Mediterranean. And what they have is a sphere, it's 17 inches in diameter, and they have 31 photomultiplier tubes, which basically face around in all directions of this sphere. This is the selected detector for that project now. And so we're actually working with the KM3NET people. They are collaborators on Pingu to not only design, but actually build some of these modules as R&D and be deployed with the Pingu strings. And so this is their first design work for a pill-shaped capsule to ultimately create these line detectors for MICA. So, summary, IceCube was completed December 2010, so just over 2 years ago. And that detector, it is exceeding its initial design performance goals in just about every way. And so it now has sensitivity, when we include deep core, between 10 GeV and 10 to the 9 GeV, so 10 orders of magnitude, which is really quite impressive. And it can look in both hemispheres of the sky. And so this is a new step forward again for the collaboration. And as you saw today, the results have really started to stringently test many of the models that have stood the test of time in astrophysics, at least, for the last two decades. And so these are big steps forward for the community. For deep core, and this is where I focus my activities, we've been running for just over 2 years. And the first results, you're seeing them today. And you're going to see a lot of new work come out this summer at the conferences. And then we fully expect improvements as we shore up our reconstruction algorithms and put the analyses in their first final state. But then again, towards the future, the self-pole may prove an attractive alternative for what people are thinking for the very large-scale detectors. And I also note that we've actually recently, just 2 years ago, we put a direct detection dark matter experiment in the ice as well. Sodium iodide, which is designed to test stringently the Dhamma signal observance of dark matter. And so those feasibility studies are underway, including a full design for a new detector, for a new direct detection dark matter detector in the ice as well. And so it's quite a vibrant program which is developing. That was it. Thanks. Yeah, that's a perfect question. So what we did 2 years ago when we were doing the last holes is we actually had our Swedish collaborators, they put a full camera system into one of the modules, into an empty module, and that got deployed into two locations in the ice. And the camera system, it had full lasers on board, which allowed it to measure the scattering directly in what we call the whole ice versus the bulk ice. And you can look for discontinuities and when the ice refreezes, whether it freezes back as a solid unit, for instance. And then the camera actually allows you to view whether there's any non-uniformity in the ice. And the truth is that there are non-uniformities. What you actually see is that when the ice freezes back, you will actually trap a column of air bubbles that you've introduced in your drilling process. But at the same time, now that we know that they're in the models. The other aspect is that there were always plans, and there are methods that you can clean this up. You can degas your water, for instance, and remove the air, and then as well as doing that, you can control the freeze back rate of the hole. And so both methods would allow you to basically allow that to escape. And so you can actually, the expectation is that you could actually return the whole ice to being essentially a pristine as the bulk ice. Yeah, those are things that we're actually working on.
So this MITE approach, MES W, is it going to be sensitive to HEP fraction of solid neutrinos?
Yeah, so it's a good question. The photocathode coverage that we can achieve by the strings. Yeah, so these strings here, they're 7-8 meters apart, and so at the 10-20 MeV level for the HEP solar neutrinos, we're not going to have the photocathode coverage to do this type of ring imaging, and so there's really my expectation is that we could not go after that in that particular detector to achieve. To achieve this for the supernovae, this is assuming that this detector is working in burst mode, meaning that essentially you're over some correlated noise rate within the individual detectors in the ice, and that's not so dissimilar from what we do with IceCube to look for supernovae right now, except that the energy threshold is much lower in this particular detector.
So regarding the neutrino non-observation, if you wanted to be provocative, what would you say about current theories?
I'll play it safe.
Don't play it safe.
So the theories are wrong. There's two possibilities either in where the theories are wrong. Either they have the proton density wrong for the GRB, and that's completely possible. If that's true, then the GRB can't possibly be a source of the ultra high energy cosmic ray. The other possibility is that the acceleration mechanism is wrong. That would be a surprise. But it's still possible, and my understanding. So the models have already changed, of course, or they are changing. We shouldn't be surprised. There was a paper on the archive, I think, a day later, which revised one of the models. And so the but the changes that they're making are with regards to the acceleration mechanism, so that there's still the possibility that they produce the ultra high energy cosmic ray. Personally, this was a huge surprise for me, the null measurement. I fully expected us to have a neutrino coincident with at least one of the 300 GRBs that we sampled, and it's pretty much shaken the community at this particular stage. From what I've seen, the new models, they haven't been so aggressive that we won't be able to retest them in 5 years with five more years of data. And of course we'll do that, but I think this is, you know, this is one of the first big puzzles which potentially eliminate a very popular source for the cosmic rays.
Okay, so if there are no further questions, let's thank Darren again.